This is the Washington Indivisible Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Cox. Chris Rakedahl is Washington's Superintendent of Public Instruction. He is currently running for a third term, and he joins us now to talk about his campaign. Superintendent Rakedahl, hello. How are you, sir?
I am good. Thanks for having me on again. It's good to see you all.
It is good to see you as well. And you know, it occurs to me, you've been on the show previously, we haven't talked about your background at all. And I think it's pertinent because I recently learned that neither of your parents actually finished school and that you grew up largely in poverty. I wonder if you could talk about this a little bit and how it informed your decision to go into education.
Yeah, so I grew up here in Washington, a little town called Snohomish. And so the real quick story on our family was big family. I'm the youngest of eight, but the oldest six siblings spent 2 years in the foster care system before my sister April and I were born because the state had essentially determined neglect in our family. My parents were alcoholics. And so the state kind of disbanded the family and they all got different placements. And then my parents did get sober and the family was reunited and they went on to have two more kids. So unfortunately, they only had an eighth grade education. They both finished middle school and that was it. And so you can imagine sort of the intergenerational risk of that, and certainly had some siblings caught up in their own challenges. But I love my family and they're amazing. And there was a lot of love in that family. But probably by fifth or sixth grade, I realized like, I want to do something different here. I got to break this a little bit. And so I was the first in my family to go straight to college. I've had siblings subsequently do that. As adults or young adults, which is great. But I was the first one to go and I knew I wanted to be a teacher. So I ended up being a teacher, school board member, and worked in the community technical college system for 14 years in our state before the legislature. So I've been really blessed to have some pretty amazing experiences that started with a love for school. Because when you're a fifth grader and you're kind of hanging your head low using food stamps at Vic's Market, the little town market near where I live on Sunday, but then in school on Monday, you're next to people who, you know, have resources because you play soccer with them on Saturday and sitting there doing math together and science together and social studies. I felt really loved and empowered, and I wanted to make sure that every kid had that chance. So that was the motivation to get into education.
Well, it's an extraordinarily inspiring story, and thank you for sharing that. I want to jump off here and talk about our schools. I know that you're aware that there are a number of reports talking about how our state has been moving in the wrong direction on things like test scores, college enrollment, and we can talk about that specifically in a moment. But you have said, when I've heard you speak about this, that people aren't hearing the good news about our education system. So what are some of the things that you would like people to know about?
Well, it's always complex, right? Through any time, especially during a crisis like COVID, there's always progress made somewhere. And sometimes there's very systemic progress, which has been exciting to watch the last couple of years. While there are challenges, COVID was definitely impactful. It impacted all of us. It's still impacting certain sectors of the economy and certain individuals. So what we've consistently said was we took a test score hit for sure. And for the period that students were learning remotely, there's no doubt that that had an impact. But we also say put it in context because we were starting to see this growing anxiety and this growing isolation sense across America for kids and Washington well before COVID. And so we're working hard to put those investments in place to turn that around. So what's happened since the depths of COVID? We put a big emphasis on early literacy. We've got a million books in the hands of kids now who never had them before they start with us as kindergartners. We've scaled up what's called transition kindergarten. So students who we know are going to be behind on day one, we get them in 6 months or even a year early to give them that jump start. We're feeding 300,000 more kids today than we were pre-pandemic. And permanently, the legislature's made permanent investments. So we're up to 700,000 plus kids in our state with access to free breakfast and lunch. We're still top 15 in the nation in test scores. So everyone wants to look at our state test, and all 50 states use something different, but there's one assessment we use in common. There's one assessment where we all across the country use the same assessments. It's called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. We test fourth graders and eighth graders in both math and English language arts. And when you look at that, we're in the top two quartiles on all four of those quadrants, fourth grade ELA, fourth grade math, eighth grade ELA, eighth grade math. And by eighth grade, we're top 10 in the nation in math, for example. And we work so hard at this. There's only two states in the nation with stronger math scores for Black African-American youth, which is really exciting. It's Massachusetts and Texas, by the way. And there are only like five states, maybe it's six, that have a smaller gap between white students and Black students in mathematics. And so We're this state that has high literacy. The country actually has high literacy. We're sixth in the world in literacy rates. And so when you're a high performing state like we are in a nation that's sixth in the world, we're always focused on literacy. But the real challenge nationally and internationally is math. So it's been really exciting to close gaps there. And we could go on. A third of our middle schoolers are now taking a high school math class before they leave. Two thirds of our high school graduates have already taken at least one college course. Most of them more than that. Record high graduation rates. And the cool part is when we look at what's happening, they're taking more core credit in high school, and we're seeing remediation rates in college go down. So not just the two-year colleges that they've been a good partner for years, but even in the 4 years. So think about those kids who used to go to a college and have to spend tuition money or even financial aid on a below 100 level course to catch up. We're at a record low in the number of kids who need to do that. So in the middle of all this challenge, which has been very real, we've had to be super intentional about the limited federal money we got. We've used it judiciously. We've been innovative in programs. We built regional mental health networks. We're seeing really good results and good progress, but it's going to take longer. This is a process when you come out of a once in a 100-year pandemic. We did a little research on World War I and World War II to find corollaries to, like, how long does this take when you go through a collective trauma? And it takes a while. It really does. So I'm pleased with the progress. There's more work to do. I'm super proud of our legislature where they've made key investments. It's had a big impact, but obviously more work to do. College enrollments is another one we should talk about because it is challenging. I will say, obviously, that's not up to us. We have prepared more students than we ever have. We have the highest grad rates, so the most kids ready to go to college, and they've had more core credit, and they need less remediation. I think we should have a pretty honest conversation about what keeps kids out of college these days. And quite frankly, it's the cost of housing and existence. Tuition's been relatively stable in our state, but right now, 60-some percent of the total cost of attendance is not actually tuition and fees, and it's just eating people alive. So this state has got to get progressive on actually investing in our public higher ed institutions and not relying so much on out-of-pocket. That is the fastest way to grow college enrollments.
Well, you know, it's an enormously complex picture that you paint here, and a lot of good news in there. I do want to give the opportunity to respond to the numbers that I think people are concerned about, some of which come from your own office. So according to numbers from the National Association for Educational Progress, fourth and eighth grade reading and math scores have fallen around 10% over the last decade. This has dropped Washington students out of the top 10 nationally. And then your office, the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, OSPI, your report shows that 50% of Washington students are at grade level for English, only 39% for math, and 42% for science. How do you respond to people who are concerned about these numbers? Are you yourself concerned about these numbers?
Well, I'm always concerned around our relative performance and whether kids have opportunities. So let's break down both of those things. The National Assessment of Educational Progress, again, given nationally, the whole country has seen declines, and actually the whole world has actually seen declines in mathematics, but the whole country in math and in reading in particular. But it's a relativity question. So when we think about reading comprehension, for example, do you read a passage? Can you memorize it? In short, can you answer a question on it? It's a skill that's important. There's a literacy component today that kids have, lots of short-term reading, lots of short-term information, and a real shift from fiction to nonfiction. Almost none of that is on the assessment. Almost none of that. So we're observing the country, our state is not alone in this, of a growing number of students who say, hey, that assessment didn't actually match what I'm being asked to learn because the world's changing so rapidly. You want me engaged in a lot of different kinds of texts than I used to be in. And the same thing in math. We've got a lot more practical and applied mathematics in the trades. It's still pretty much an academic test. The goal, I mean, historically, and I think inappropriately, was to get every kid to calculus. And so the country's grappling with math. These are awfully small scale score difference changes on a 5,000 point scale. I think there's a 17 or 20 point scale score difference. So we watch this closely. What we really do is dive into the research. So what matters for kids is not a nationally mandated federal state test. It's what courses are they taking? Are they getting access to advanced courses? And we've doubled the number of kids getting highly capable advanced courses, and the fastest group are students of color. And so are they getting the courses they need to attend college and post-secondary? And on that, the stuff that has always mattered, we're seeing the best progress we've seen in a very long time. So we'll look at the federally mandated exams. I think it's worth worrying through why the whole country is seeing this for sure. And then as far as the state exams, I'm always going to tell folks that There is no regulation by the federal government on cut scores. So we have states who set their cut score so low that it looks like 80 or 90% of their kids are doing great. We have the highest bar in the country with the Smarter Balanced Assessment. Again, when you go back to NAEP and then you compare those states, we outperform nearly all of them. And then there's some other tricks that other states are doing. I think there's other folks who say Washington's not even as good as Mississippi or Alabama today. Again, if you use their state test, it's apples to oranges. But when you use the NAEP test, you also have to understand that a dozen states now hold back a large percentage of their third graders as a forced policy. So our kids as eight-year-olds are competing, if you will, in tests with a bunch of kids who are 9 years old and developmentally. That is a monstrous change. We generally surpass those states anyways by eighth grade, even though they've got a chunk of kids who are a year older. And there's some really good research that says holding kids and forcibly holding them back, it improves your test scores for a little while. It doesn't get you ultimately a better result. And in fact, there's some research that says kids feel that socially and emotionally, and dropout rates are higher, which is why the South still has these high dropout rates, even though it looks like their fourth grade scores appear to get better. We move right to them or beyond them by eighth grade.
Well, I mean, certainly we know that, that data is quite malleable, and it really sort of depends on what aspect you want to, you know, drill in. And, you know, I also know that federally mandated exams have a wide variety of opinions on those. So I do want to shift and talk with you about school funding, since this is, I think, something that is on the minds of a lot of voters. You know, the McCleary ruling a couple years back, the courts forced the legislature to fully fund schools. But a number of education advocates, I believe yourself included, note that there are still so many areas where our schools continue to come up short. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about why this is and which areas still need more resources.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to think about this for folks is what did the state Supreme Court require of the legislature? It wasn't a big investment, ironically, as a requirement. It was basically do your job. So whatever formulas were in place, the court said, well, at least fund the things you put in place. You said that class size should be a certain size, and you said transportation should be funded, so go do that. And our legislature, for the most part, did that. They worked really hard, I will say, to try to get to the right place. We think they came up short immediately in special education. So supports for students with disabilities is both a federal and a civil positive right. It is articulated in law and it's clear. So we would say if any district's still using local levy monies to provide those basic services, then we're not fully funding. So we think right out of the gate, special ed was a problem. And that's probably $400 million, maybe $300 million per fiscal year, right out of the gate. But then we go back to those underlying formulas and did transportation get funded and did all day kindergarten and did compensation? And for the most part, people would say yes. The problem was it peaked in 2019. And then when we look at it adjusted for inflation, we've lost ground. We've lost $1,000 per student. So it isn't that the nominal dollars aren't growing because the legislature is getting more tax revenue and all of that. It's that the actual cost of running a school or paying people or surviving, right, is gone way faster than the state funding formula. So we're down about $1,000 a student. That's $1 billion a year right now, just to do the program of 2019. So we would say, you also don't have to just write blank checks. Like, let's get to that funding level that's appropriate, and then let's be super innovative. So funding supports for students with disabilities is innovative. Making sure kids eat is innovative. We have added counselors and nurses and mental health specialists for the last several years. Let's sustain those. We built a regional mental health network that's amazing. We just had the best scores we've ever seen from students, self-reporting, lower anxiety, better connection with adults, lower suicide ideation. Pre-pandemic, we were about 70 to 75 youth, students, unfortunately dying by suicide, and it's down to 56. Now it's one is too many, but we've made really important progress. So those are the things where we say to the legislature, like, come with us, let's make that investment, let's meet that legal obligation, but let's be super creative and innovative about where we put those dollars, because we can keep propelling learning. We can continue to see what we've seen, which is acceleration in test scores, grad rates, credits taken, more career in tech ed. We can do more of this innovation, but we do have to we have to be a little uncomfortable with the fact that we didn't just race up to the mountain and ring the McCleary bell and say we're fully funded now. You got to maintain that, and it slipped a little bit.
Well, you're talking about being creative with the money that is coming in. I wonder if we might talk about funding models a little bit. I think people can be frustrated that, you know, you mentioned levies. Shortfalls are generally filled by property tax, bonds, and levies. I believe $5.2 billion came from that in the most recent funding cycle. What sorts of changes are possible as you see them in our school's funding model? I know you've touted the new capital gains tax. Is there a model or models that might get us closer to a funding level that you'd be happier with?
There's two sides to that question. There's the revenue, right, which the legislature is clearly going to deal with. But I've taken as much risk as I can, and I'll keep taking risks to say if what we do is keep fighting over the existing structure, we will continually starve higher ed and K-12 and the social safety net and climate justice, because we have a tax code that's extracting less and less GDP every single year. And so there's an inevitable reality that if you don't start taxing where the growth in the economy is, as opposed to consumption or even property, as much as we depend on it. So let's be candid that as progressives, we can't let go of this conversation that we need tax reform before you can solve all the expenditure needs. Otherwise, we're just going to keep reshuffling the deck, and that's an injustice, particularly to the climate and our elderly and our most vulnerable families. So what do? We run these funding formulas to try to replicate where every student deserves a basic ed. Our legislature said, hey, it costs a whole lot more to buy things and to pay people to survive in the Puget Sound than it does rural Washington. So they made an adjustment for that. And by the way, there are people who say that's unfair. I mean, they just look at the math and they say, well, you're driving more money to the places that, you know, have more money. And it's a fair conversation. It's just, there's the other side of fairness is every kid should have a really talented educator in front of them. And people making the exact same amount of money in, say, Yakima County versus King County, it's not going to get that result. You do have to pay people more where there's higher cost. The old model did that through levies. The old model just said, okay, the state's got a basic level, now go use your levies. And that wasn't exactly fair. So during the McCleary budget discussions, the legislature codified that. They now use state formulas to try to adjust regional cost of living differences for staff. So I don't think they're going to abandon that. What we have said is, let's then also have categorical money that focuses on what kids really need. So we're working on a model right now that's a student-weighted concept. So fund the adults to make sure they can survive and thrive in the communities in which they live. And then let's have targeted, protected money that's student program focused and drive that towards poverty. And then you're going to send more money to the places where the kids need the most supports. And we have a little bit of that today. We have what's called Title I money and learning assistance. We want to add to that and tweak that formula and really make sure that students who need the most support get the most support. And that will be in our budget request that we unveil to the legislature and the governor later this summer.
You talk about going to where the revenue is and, skewing a fund or really constructing a funding model accordingly. I mentioned the capital gains tax. Listeners to the show know that there is a GOP-backed initiative on this November's ballot that would get rid of the capital gains tax. And this, I believe, would cut almost $1 billion a year from education. Listeners to the show are about to go out and start canvassing. I wonder what you believe we should be saying to, say, undecided voters who, maybe on the fence about whether or not to vote for this measure.
Yeah, in a state that has a constitutional obligation to fund basic education, if we don't
use paramount duty, so the Constitution goes.
If we don't start shifting to progressive ideas like, capital gains, really genuinely looking at a wealth tax, if we don't start figuring out how to make a more fair tax system, then you're talking about 2 and 3 and 4 times the tax rate for our lowest income families to fund a system that they need. So, Defend Washington matters a ton. Get out there and protect the capital gains, the Climate Commitment Act. This stuff really, really matters. Most of that's going to really important environmental justice, but there is some of the Climate Commitment Act scheduled to come to a K-12 system, for example. So we can want a system to be better and use traditional systems that take a while, or we can go straight to the ballot and defend the progress that we have made. So I do hope folks will turn out and be very, very intentional about this. It's a start. The alternative is we're still going to fund our constitutional mandate, and we're going to turn to things like sales tax and property tax if we're not careful. And that is even more regressive, especially sales tax. So I hope folks will work hard to defend the progressive progress we have made. And I've sponsored bills like this when I was in the legislature too, capital gains. I did sponsor an income tax, and I believe in it then. I believe in it today. If it's got the ability to offer some tax relief and make it more progressive for low-income families, targeted to education and healthcare. So these are hard things to do, and we have a culture in this state of fear. But if we're serious about really, really being the progressive state that we claim we are, you can't just do it when it comes to civil rights, which I think we do a pretty good job on. You got to do it in the tax code, too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Taxes are always a reflection of our values, as many are wont to say. And thank you. I was remiss in the Climate Commitment Act also funding education as well. And of course, folks may or may not have known that you served in the legislature for, I believe it was 3 terms, yes?
Yeah, 3 terms, 6 years. Yeah.
You know, speaking indirectly of the GOP, you have pointed out that candidates and funders for your position are some of whom may be looking to privatize our schools. And this represents a clear and present danger in our state. Talk a little bit about this threat and how you feel that we push back effectively here.
Yeah, I mean, let's first talk about that term privatization. So I happen to believe that core civil rights, and I consider basic education one of them, really has to be accountable in the public sector. And I mean that from publicly elected boards, public funding and public access for kids and public accountability. So there's a continuum of privatization. There's things as innocent as buying textbooks from a publisher, and they make profit off of that. Well, most people would say, yeah, we may not have the horsepower everywhere to build our own textbooks, but you got to be careful about that because those national publishers have a lot of implicit bias in them. And we've seen publishers change things for states to hide our real history, for example. So that's a small example all the way to the extreme. We now have 24 states that have put vouchers in place. They literally take taxpayer money and treat it as a private right instead of a public good. And folks are walking these to their church-based schools, religious-based institutions, for-profit company, testing companies. Even something this tutoring seems really innocent. Who doesn't want more tutoring? Well, here's what I would say. You have 25,000 to 30,000 paraeducators in this state. They're generally hourly workers. They don't get annual contracts, generally. They're 1,200 hours. They don't make a living wage. So I proposed a living wage this year, an increase of $7 an hour so that they could really thrive and sustain themselves. That is a form of really investing in the public sector because they're publicly hired. They're there every day. They have high contact time with kids, especially for reading supports and students with disabilities. And there are folks everywhere, including in this race, who would say, we need to invest in these tutoring companies. Well, you're going to send money to folks who don't build relationships with kids. If you don't sustain it, the research says it isn't a very good idea. So I'd say be careful of folks who say, I don't believe in privatization, but then, you know, get a lot of money from the charter community and charter supporters. Or they get money from hedge funds, or they get money from, you know, venture capitalists. The track record is so clear around the country where these people are. They always start with the small and they always start with charters. And then they say, well, let's expand those. And then eventually they say, you know what? We really just believe in a market system where everyone should take their public dollar and go. Can you imagine if all of us found something in the public sector we didn't like and tried to turn it into a voucher? We would gut core public safety services. Our state parks would be wiped out because people would say, I never visit them, so give me my $200 and I'll subsidize my trip to Disneyland. So do we believe as progressives in the fundamental democratic institutions of the public good? And if we do, we've got to defend those rigorously and don't believe it can't happen here. Okay. In all the states that started with charters, they finished with vouchers. Well, in 3/4 of them, but they always started with charters. And they say, well, I'm not really a charter fan, but it, you know, it is what it is. Well, just be careful. I think the intention behind those, for example, are good. The heart is there. It is a form of privatization. And there is less accountability, I believe, because the boards aren't publicly elected. They don't have to go out to their voters, right, every so often and say, here's proof that we're doing good work. And so support us with at least 17% of our budget the way public schools do. So I'd say the heart is there, the compassion's there. Be super careful of the slippery slope. I just had 3 colleagues who are, by the way, Republicans in other states, get wiped out by people further to their right, exclusively on the idea of vouchers.
Wow. You know, if you listen closely, you can actually hear people affirming what you're saying emphatically. So, yes. Yeah. Slippery slope, indeed. You know, as we touched on earlier, we know that there is a great deal of inequity between school districts in the state, particularly in some of our urban and rural districts. You mentioned Title I and LAP programs. You and I were discussing before we got started just how state and federal money is apportioned. There's a formula for state money. OSPI has no say in how federal education dollars are spent. So what do you think OSPI can do to create some more equity between our school districts here in the state?
Well, the cool part is our legislature closed some of that gap. Pre-McCleary, the gaps were even bigger. And they did step in and say, as a state, we're going to fund more of that. And they reduced the dependence on local levies. It was about 30% before. It's about 17% today. And everyone has kind of a different opinion. I always think there should be something from a public accountability standpoint you go out for. But it really should be for enrichment, right? Not core services. So I do like this idea. It's in other states. We'll do it, I hope, as good or better in other states. This idea of a student-weighted model would drive more money to high-poverty communities. You'd be driving programmatic dollars to students who need the most support. I think a lot of districts do this work today, but they rely a little bit on their levies. So I'd like to see that. And I don't give up on the federal government. They're using a formula today that I think is really unhelpful for Washington State. Because they often rely on the percentage of poverty, and we're a fairly wealthy state. So we have a lot of families in distress, and that same family in this state gets less money per capita than other parts of the country.
Even though we have a lot of impoverished areas in this state.
We do. And so recognizing where the need is, instead of just blanket looking at data and saying, well, Washington's a relatively wealthy state, so they get less Title I money. I think there's an opportunity, and we'll keep pushing for that. But in our own state, let's drive money where it really needs to go. Recognizing that there is regional cost of living differences to make sure educators are made whole as well. But these are the things that we really can do and we are doing. It's just, it's pretty limited money today. And I think we should lean into it a little more aggressively.
You've talked, you've touched on this quite a bit in our discussion here so far about, really prioritizing, elevating our teachers. You're focused on teacher recruitment with an emphasis on diversity, I should add. You've noted that our teachers are now over 30% diverse, which is fantastic. What are some things specifically you're doing to increase recruitment and also retention?
Yeah, so that data is our new teachers. So our teachers in the last 4 or 5 years, about 30% of them coming in are teachers of color. So it's really changing the overall a lot, because we have had a big retirement surge as well, which were predominantly older white educators. So we're really intentional in a couple of ways. Number one, our higher ed institutions, they do a really good job trying to make that profession accessible to folks. Now, nationally, higher ed enrollments and teacher prep programs is down, has been for 30 years. So we don't just rely on them, but a shout out to our colleges and universities that have been intentional. We have a residency model now. I started this with federal dollars, and our legislature has graciously picked up some of this. We had this idea, let's go straight to labor, essentially like an apprenticeship program. Where people already have a bachelor's degree, but they haven't had a teaching certificate. They don't have one. So getting them real experience in classrooms and then support of peer educators through the Washington Education Association, we're the first in the country to do this. We're probably going to turn this into a full-blown teacher apprenticeship program in the state, a certified and registered apprenticeship program. And it's just absolutely exciting, because they are far more diverse in that program. Many of them are those paraeducators I talked about. So we also have these para to teacher pipelines, where districts, a little bit of state money, but a lot of districts invest directly in their para educators. They've made a choice. I want to work with kids and I love this work, but I want my own classroom and I want to really understand developmentally what's going on with kids, and I want to evaluate their learning. That's a key part in the law that teachers get to do. So we have been intentional around investing who's in front of kids, and then mentorship programs. It doesn't make sense to bring folks in and then not support them. So very intentional mentorship programs for multiple years. We're seeing really good retention with that. And we're seeing that our educators of color are staying in the system with the same persistence rates as our white educators. So really proud of the system, proud of labor. That's the partnership. I'm a former member of three labor unions. I do this work because I really believe the people in the classroom know what's best. So, God, it's so cool to turn this over to them in some ways and say, like in other trades, you know best, train your replacement or train your peer. And it's pretty amazing.
You mentioned paraeducators. In our last legislative session here, lawmakers in the House, I believe, wanted to increase money for supplies, operations, and maintenance. And the Senate was looking to take from that budget and give more to paraeducators. You can correct me if I don't have that right. But if I do, where do you land on that? Paraeducators, I believe, are currently on strike in Port Angeles over this issue. What is your take?
Well, I know not everyone's happy about this, but I started this because we did the analysis and said our paraeducators are turning over 50% of them every 5 years. And these are folks who are remarkable. I just can't use any different word. They come to this work knowing that it is not always full time. They don't get a year-round contract in most cases. So they do this out of heart work, and they're more likely to support our students who need reading support. They're more likely to work with students with disabilities and students with behavioral health needs. So they're just amazing. And the best chance we have for student improvement is this amazing 25,000 people who are paras. So rather than send money to the private sector and, you know, unproven tutoring models, let's pay them a living wage so they stay in the profession. We invest in their education early on. Let's keep them. So I proposed this $7 an hour on average increase because we did the math of what it takes to really survive in the King County and in other parts of the state. And we, you know, we regionalized that. But this was a concept that came out of my office. We wrote the first draft of this. It is not uniformly loved, I will tell you, because there's always the worry that the legislature will put the policy in place and not fund it. This year, they made $70+ million worth of progress on that, which is really cool. We're excited. We'll come back to try to keep making progress, and we'll try to bring along administrators to say, I know this can be challenging for you locally at times, but this is the future of our workforce, and we have to invest deeply because they have a huge impact on kids. So that's where we came from. That's why we kicked this off. I'm grateful for the progress the legislature made. There's more progress to make.
Let's shift gears and talk about our students. You've said that you would like to see more focus on media literacy and education for things like mis and disinformation. I am heartily in favor of that. We know that OSPI has essentially no say on school curricula, but talk about this need as you see it, and what are some of the things you'd like to do here?
Yeah, curriculum decisions are made locally, but what OSPI clearly has authority on is learning standards. So I'd encourage everyone to think about it as like a pyramid. At the top is the learning standards. What do we expect a third grader to know in math or a sixth grader to know in social studies? The school districts adopt the curriculum. In other words, what textbooks are we buying or what materials? And then the teacher in the classroom is the decider of how to deploy the lesson plans and the strategies. So we do have standards, which is why I'm into this work. We built these regional mental health networks the last 2.5 years with incredible results. Again, the best student data we've seen in terms of their feeling better, more self-confident, less anxiety, suicide rates down. But those are response systems when students need help. What I want to be more honest about and what I'm trying to lead the country in is this idea that, well, let's get to the source of this. Why have we seen growing anxiety for 12 years straight in this country, not just our state? It happened to correlate about 12 or 13 years ago when a majority of our students in middle and high school had access to smartphones. Soon as they saw every horrible thing in the world happen in front of them, and then these horrific algorithms chased them around with more news just like it once they saw a customer click, we have built this concept and this mental model for kids that says everything's awful.
and actually, adults, can I just jump in there and ask you, this is at a point when much of our cognitive, our brain development really is still in process, right? So children are far more vulnerable to this sort of thing.
100%. So it's from that brain research that we said, why do we believe that social media, for example, is something that lives outside of the school reality? It's right in front of us. Not only are students using devices, which more and more districts are bringing under control, but it's impacting them. So we're the standards people. So what we've launched at OSPI is maybe the most ambitious thing in our learning standards ever, which is to relook at English language arts and math right now, but it'll get to all the content areas with very intentional learning standards, research-based, at every single grade level. So starting with our 4 and 5 year olds who come in, the building blocks of media literacy is what's in front of you? Why is it in front of you? Who wants you to be influenced? Are you influenced? What's another perspective? So think about it as building critical thinkers, not cynical thinkers, but critical thinkers of information so that they begin to understand that there's some intention out there for misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda. I genuinely believe the biggest risk to our republic is that few players get to control so much information in the minds of young people that they can't escape somebody else's definition of reality. So we're going to empower kids. And it means professional learning for educators, adopting these standards by grade level, really building the materials. We're into the work now. Those adoptions will be done later this year. It's a massive effort. And I don't think there's anything more important, literally, for the survival of our democracy than getting students aware of what's in front of them, because more and more of it's going to come their way. So let's lean in. Let's empower them so they don't get cynical and they don't get just torn down, but they say, I know what's in front of me and why, and I know how to make decisions with this information differently.
This is another one of those instances where I can hear people affirming what you're saying here. Build critical thinkers, not cynical thinkers. Related to this, I know that the OSPI recently put out guidelines for use of AI in schools. You said that you felt that schools got, quote, run over by social media a decade ago for many of the reasons that you just discussed. How do we make sure that this isn't happening with AI?
Yeah, not looking the other way, right? With social media, we said, either that'll never take off, or parents will make sure that those phones go off at 8 o'clock at night, or kids will self-regulate. So we really just didn't do the work across the country and across the globe to understand brain development. So with AI, what we're saying is, this is another powerful technology that can be used for good or can be used adversely. So let's lean into it. Let's understand that kids are going to use it. They're already using it. Teachers are already using it to build incredible content right now. So let's not look the other way and pretend that, you know, it's okay for a student to hit a single button and produce a 5-page paper and turn it in. Let's say, yeah, you're probably going to do that. So now teaching and learning isn't about going to get the information. It isn't the card catalog or even web research that we did. It's really okay. You can get it.
You're dating us. You're dating us.
Yeah. You can get the information quickly and you can produce it. Now let's spend class time understanding what came in. Why that perspective? Was it research? Was it backed by citation? How will you go affirm it? And, you know, we see some amazing teaching models today where they say, now go produce it any way you want. Now, when you come into class, I want you to take the opposite perspective. I want you to write it right here. I want you to flip their arguments around. So again, creating critical thinkers, using the technology to empower critical thinking, the production's going to be easy. Everyone's going to be able to produce a thing, right? So let's stop making student scores about whether they can go out and get a thing, which, by the way, has been very discriminatory for decades and decades. Volumes of homework, especially if you require technology, has really harmed kids who go home who do not have connectivity and technology. So let's use the classroom now to think critically, because the technology is going to be there. We already have one-to-one devices in almost every district. So the production's easy. Now it's time to think critically. So that's what we're leaning into. We've issued two phases of guidance already because there's student data privacy that has to come with it. We already have it, but now they've got to change their policies. There is testing, cheating policy that has to be updated, right? Kids have always taken shortcuts, and now we need to say to them, you can't take a shortcut with this either. So I'm really excited about what we're doing. We're being cautious by putting the learning first and the opportunity first, instead of just saying to districts, go out and buy the next software tool that has AI. We're actually telling them, slow your roll on purchasing something that might come and go fast. Let's build the learning standards and the expectations right now.
Before I let you go, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about legislation. As we've discussed here, this is a place where the OSPI can really make, has a huge impact here. I know that there are several pieces of legislation, some of which you've already discussed, but talk a little bit about some of the things, maybe three or four things you haven't talked about already that you'd like to see in next year's long session.
Well, we have talked about budget, and it's always going to be about trying to shore that up. But again, what are the component parts of that? So really investing in high poverty communities and students who need the most help, really sustaining the people who are in front of kids. So think about this as the most valuable asset in a school is not the whiz bang book or technology we buy. It's the people. So the paraeducators and the teachers and those nurses. So that'll be key. I want to feed every child. I came out with this 2 years ago as an announcement and said, this state should have a goal of when a kid comes to school, and lots of them won't want it or need it, but when they come to school and they're hungry, breakfast and lunch should be available to them. We put this out there. I'm super proud of our legislature that made progress. Let's close that out. Like, let's really close that out. And then the last thing I'd say is we're going to keep making progress on this idea that the best, most affordable way to get kids college credit is while they're already sitting in their high school getting it paid for under basic ed. So when a student's ready to do college level mathematics and science and reading, we already have great programs. Let's get rid of all the fees for those now, because it's disproportionately impacting low income families. We wiped out the fees on college and the high school. It's time to wipe out those instructional fees and running start. This is where I keep saying to folks, we actually have really high college participation rates because 50,000 kids in every graduating class already have college and a transcript started. It's then making sure that they want to transition to the next step. And what's keeping them from doing that is the cost of going residential and living separately and paying another rent. So let's get them the college credit they need, paid for with basic ed with us. It is good for everybody at the end of the day.
Before I let you go, where can people learn more about your campaign?
Well, my name isn't easy to spell, but you'll find it if you get close. ChrisRakedal.org. That's an Icelandic name, by the way. So ChrisRakedal.org is where you'll find all the campaign info. And we try to go into a level of depth on the policy ideas and what we've already done and where we have gaps and be honest about that. You're going to see a host of endorsements from progressives across the state, organizations and labor and members of Congress and super proud of Congresswoman Jayapal and Strickland coming on the team and supporting. And so, yeah, that's where folks can go, learn about issues. And then, you know, they can call me 360-790-3151. That is my cell phone number, and I take those calls. And sometimes I got to get it scheduled because I'm kind of running around. But I want folks to reach out with questions, and I want them to say, hey, what about this? And generally, we can get them the right place or get them the right resources. So 360-790-315.
Well, listen, I know that you're incredibly busy. You have been traveling a ton all over our state. This is a statewide position. You, of course, are doing your job as superintendent. We so appreciate the work that you do, and we really appreciate you taking the time today.
Great to see you. Thanks a lot.
Nice to see you as well. And that'll do it for this week. The executive producer of the show is Kat Pipkin. If you would like to see a video version of this podcast, head to facebook.com/indivisiblepodcast. The email address for the show is indivisiblepodcast@gmail.com. Special thanks to Lori Colwell. And as always, my thanks to you for listening. I'm Stephen Cox, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.